Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Should you be learning about financial literacy at work? There can be some pretty solid benefits for both the employee and the employer. Certified financial planner Steve Bridge is here to take us through what a financial literacy program at work might look like and why he believes it's important. Then, for some people in the Muslim community, a husband and wife might sign a mar agreement. This is something I hadn't heard of. It's fascinating. It is a contract that details a gift made by the husband to the wife that could value more than 100 grand. I mean, it can be a small amount, it can be a big amount, but certainly relevant as you think about that contract that you are signing and what could happen if you end up pursuing a divorce. Shulman and Partner says these kinds of contracts are becoming more and more common. And we'll talk to family lawyer Laura Paris to talk about what you need to know before you sign. And according to the latest Mercer Retirement Readiness Barometer, millennials who rent for their entire careers will have to save more for retirement than homeowners who made the choice to buy a house in order to achieve a reasonable income in retirement. Jillian Kennedy is a partner at Mercer Canada. She'll talk more about those findings. Plus, a strategy that could help you reduce your tax bill and grow your net worth. Now, admittedly, it is targeted for high net worth, even ultra high net worth individuals, but we can dream, right? I'll speak with Darren Shawsbury, the founder of 33/7, about the tax-free zone concept and how it works. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. If you're a member of the Muslim community, you may have already heard of something called a mar contract or Islamic marriage certificate. It is a document signed by the soon-to-be bride and groom, and it details, it details a gift made by the husband to his wife. The gift can be valued at more than $100,000, so you can imagine that there is an obvious connection to personal finances. This is something that's becoming more common in Canada, and Shulman and Partners is taking a closer look. For more on how they work, we're joined by family lawyer Laura Paris. She's in Bolton, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I am well. I saw this come across my computer screen, and I thought, I have never heard of the MAR agreement. Can you tell us what it is and how it works?
Yeah, so I won't purport to be a full historian on this, but I will give you a high level of what my understanding of the background of this is. So it is a religious contract, and it is, as you said, something that comes up in Islamic law. From what I understand, the laws, traditionally, the laws in Islamic countries did not provide for, similar property divisions to what we see here. So women were almost at a disadvantage to an extent with respect to anything that may happen in the event of a separation from their marriage. So the MAR contract was put in place essentially to provide a means of support for the wife in the event there was a breakdown of the relationship, whether it be by virtue of a divorce or even just the death of their spouse. And again, this is just a kind of an added protection to add on to what the law already provided for them to ensure that there was some adequate support, whether by way of property or otherwise, to allow them to continue on with their life absent their spouse.
How does this work here in Canada? So you reference this as being a religious contract. Do the courts here recognize this agreement?
We do. So the courts look at these contracts in the same way they would as any other domestic contract. So when we're determining how they play into our laws here, the first thing that we want to determine is whether or not it's a valid contract. And in determining whether or not it's valid, there's three requirements. It needs to be in writing, it needs to be signed, and it needs to be witnessed. Those are the three basic requirements of a valid domestic contract. In the event we are able to determine that it is that the agreement is valid, it's then the next step to determine how that contract or what the implications of that contract are on the way that we interpret our laws. So in a lot of cases where we see this contract coming up is in how we're dealing with property division for our clients in the case of a separation.
And how can you play that example out a little bit? How would that work?
Absolutely. So, for example, let's say that there's different ways of drafting these types of contracts, but let's say the contract is very simple in that it sets out an amount that is payable to the wife in the event of, a separation of some sort or at a later date. Just to kind of backtrack for a second, the way that these contracts are set out is that it's an amount that's payable upon demand. So it may not be necessarily triggered by the date of divorce. It could be triggered by other occurrences. So there are different nuances that you can put into these contracts. But let's assume that we're talking about one that is only becoming payable upon, or it's being requested to be payable upon, the date of divorce. Where the case law is going with this is that it's showing us actually including this as an asset to the wife and a debt to the husband as of the date of separation. So the implication of that is it's going to reduce what the husband's net assets are, and it's going to increase what the wife's net assets are, and as a result have an impact on what the ultimate equalization amount received is. So where we're seeing a lot of disputes on this is a lot of people want to see this contract actually being dealt with separately from the provincial law. But in order to do that, the agreement actually has to specifically state that it's intended to be excluded. And this is where we're seeing a lot of the disputes involving this contract.
You use the terms husband and wife. And of course, we know for the last almost 20 years in Canada, same-sex marriages are both legal and pretty common. Is this something that really does still live in a gendered world?
In terms of the terminology, or do you mean these types of contracts still coming to be?
Could two women or two men sign a MAR agreement?
So, from that perspective, I will be frank, I do not know the answer to that question. I do believe that it would be in line with Islamic law. So where our laws have gone in terms of the advancements that we've made over the last 20 years in Canadian law, this particular contract, this MAR contract, is subject to Islamic law, which is religious law. So I will be frank that I don't know what the advancements of that law are and whether or not this would be something that applies to a woman and woman relationship or a man and man. From the research that I have done, I've only seen it referred to dealing with a husband and wife relationship.
We've used the word gift a number of times here. It details a gift made by the husband to the wife. Does that word carry legal weight, or is it in this context synonymous with an amount?
So again, it depends on actually how the contract is drafted. So you could specifically set it out in a manner that refers to it as a gift for the purpose of having it excluded from any sort of further property regime that may be applicable at the time of separation. But the language that is included in these agreements is key. And I think this is where people need to be informed, and people need to realize that while these are religious contracts, and it may not be a contract that you actually sign with a lawyer, it still does make sense to have a conversation with a lawyer before entering into these types of agreements to understand what implications this could have in the event of a separation, and if there is any language that should be included within these contracts at the time of marriage to ensure that you're protecting yourself at a later date.
Where does this fit with a prenup?
I would say it goes hand in hand with the prenup. The only difference I'd say between the two is one is based on religious law and one is based on provincial law. So, but the two pieces go hand in hand, and they are treated more or less in the same way as a marriage contract. The only difference that you're going to see is that one is subject to and is based on religious law, and the other is based on secular government or sorry provincial law.
This is an anecdotal, or looking for an anecdotal answer here versus a statistic, but how common are these agreements in the Muslim community?
As far in my experience, I would say they are very common. I have not in my practice dealt with a Islamic separation that did not include a MAR contract. That said, The way that they actually play into these separations varies. A lot of people do simply deal with it separately from their separation that we deal with based on provincial law. So I haven't necessarily dealt with it often in the context of my role, but I do often see them come up, whether or not I have to specifically deal with them.
We used the $100,000 number here just to illustrate the magnitude. What have you seen in terms of amounts that are commonly included here? I can imagine it is a very wide range depending on the economic circumstances of the couple.
Exactly. You can see numbers that are, you know, as small as, if you consider it small as $10,000 or, you know, as high as $200,000-$300,000. It's also not always a dollar amount. I've seen gold bars being a term of a MAR contract. I've seen property being a term of a MAR contract. So it really depends. And these again are terms that that are come to by the parties at the time they enter into the marriage. And it's actually a requirement of a valid marriage under Islamic law to have this agreement in place.
And you're seeing them mostly on the dissolution of a marriage.
Correct. Yeah. And again, and I think that's where people need to be informed that it is actually quite valuable to have a conversation with a family lawyer going into a marriage if you are entering into such a contract.
Well, and let's broaden this out here. If you're entering into a marriage, period, full stop, we know the stats are against you. A very high percentage of marriages do end in divorce. So let's say we can park aside the concerns some couples would have about even talking to a lawyer. It should be all about the love. It should all about choosing our first home together and all about those magical things, but it's not. It is a contractual arrangement at its base. What are the top two or three things that a couple should ask themselves and consider papering in a legal context before they walk down that metaphorical aisle?
So I would say probably two main categories of things to consider. One is property and assets that you have that you may be bringing into the relationship and looking to protect. This could include assets that personally belong to you or assets that you expect to receive by way of gift or inheritance later in life, maybe that belong to your family. The second piece would be having an understanding of support and potential support implications in the event of a relationship ends. So if you are a higher income earner and you earn significantly more than your spouse, having a term within a potential, you know, marriage contract or cohabitation agreement that deals with or restricts and limits the amount of support that you may be exposed to at a later date is certainly something to consider. Unfortunately, these contracts don't deal with any sort of parenting issues. So while these may be conversations that you may still want to have, nothing within one of these contracts dealing with any sort of parenting arrangements or support for children is actually enforceable. So while you can technically include it, it would not be enforceable at the end of the road.
Really interesting stuff. Laura, thank you for joining us to talk about this.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Paris is a family lawyer with the firm Shulman & Partners, and she was here to talk about the Islamic marriage certificate. It's called a MAR contract or a MAR agreement, something I had not heard of, and one of those things that would be really important to research before you sign on the dotted line. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, I will talk to certified financial planner Steve Bridge about financial literacy in the workplace. There are a lot of people who are big proponents of having that education available at work. We'll talk about the who, what, when, where, and why. And later, the latest findings from the Mercer Retirement Readiness Barometer. That's a mouthful. Mercer Canada partner Jillian Kennedy will be our guest. If you want to get caught up on prior episodes of Moolala, we're approaching 200, if you can possibly imagine. Head on over to moolala.ca to listen to episodes by name, by topic, or to any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen. To download the full show, write a review, or subscribe so the next episode will just arrive downloaded on your device.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. I happen to think financial literacy is really, 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 really important, which will surprise no one given that I've been hosting this show for years. I've written books. I've been talking about money for two decades. But where it could receive even more airtime is at work. And there are certainly some employers who value financial wellness. They think about it almost in the same way as they think about physical wellness or mental health wellness. And today we're going to focus on financial literacy in the workplace, what that means, who you can resource, all those sorts of things. Our guest is Steve Bridge. He is an advice-only financial planner. He works with Money Coaches Canada, and he joins us now from Vancouver. Hello there.
Good day, Bruce.
So you see clients one-to-one all the time. You also do work in organizations. Why is that an opportunity? Why is that important?
Well, there's two reasons it's an opportunity. One is, the main one is that I can reach more people than working one-on-one with a couple. You know, you help them and maybe help their kids or something like that. But speaking to a group of people, you're impacting that many more people at one time.
When an employer is considering bringing someone in to talk about financial literacy, do you think this works in every organization, or does it really need to be consistent with the values of the organization in which they think holistically about an employee's life?
Yeah, and there's... Ideally, it's for altruistic purposes, that they want to improve the financial decisions that their employees make, improve the financial situation of their employees. There's also a selfish reason to do it. Well, why don't we start with that one first and then go to the altruistic one. Almost half of Canadians have stated that worrying about money impacts their performance at work, to the point where cash-strapped employees are almost six times more likely to miss deadlines and almost five times more likely to produce lower quality work. So you could say they can do it to improve their bottom line or their efficiency or the productivity of their organization. The good ones will do it because they care about their employees and they want to improve their financial situation. As you and I know, money is the number one thing that people stress over. And this does impact their time at work. We weren't taught these things in school. It's starting to change a little bit, we're happy to say. But without hiring someone and without trying to wade through the internet, where can someone get solid information on finances?
And you and I could talk about money literally for days, weeks, and months because it's our work, it's our passion. If you've got an hour with an employer, with a group of employees in a cafeteria or on a Zoom call, what are the top one or two topics you want to ensure that you cover?
Bruce, it's the stuff that you have been going on for quite a long time, me almost as long. It's the fundamentals. It is the goals. What's important to me? Is my money going towards them? It is net worth. Is there any better barometer of how you're doing than net worth? What are my assets? What are my liabilities? Tracking those over months and years to see if it's going the right way. And then the big one is cash flow. The money coming in, the money going out. Am I spending more than what's coming in? That's where I start. If I have a limited time, and that's where I would recommend that everybody start with those things.
I'm going to take the case that some of our listeners actually have a line item in their budget for this sort of thing. What should they expect to pay to have someone come in and talk to their people about money?
Right. It as many things in personal finance, it depends. You might get someone willing to come in for free on a pro bono basis, maybe for a few hundred bucks an hour. An expert speaker might cost up to a few thousand dollars for an hour session. Now, on that, a company, a human resource department might want to look at the purpose of the person coming in, their background. Are they there with a background with the idea of perhaps selling a product or pitching a product or service? And I may be a little bit biased here. My preference would be an advice-only financial planner or money coach, someone who has been in the trenches with people's finances and who isn't there to sell products right off the bat. Nothing wrong with selling products, of course, but having a solid grip on the fundamentals and being more knowledgeable about making choices around products, investments, insurance should be in place before you actually go and buy the products and investments.
Yeah. And certainly, I remember just in the beginning of my financial literacy work, there was never a very big budget. And there were lots of people who were happy to come in and do a kind of a seminar because it was a business development opportunity for them. That was a way they could attract, you know, financial planning clients. It's not to say that they didn't provide value, but it is a different context for that. For that visit, I want to ask you about so in a smaller room or a room in which you can have more intimacy, what is the level of disclosure you would expect to have with a room of people, given that these are your peers, these are your coworkers? People can be reticent about talking authentically about what's really going on in their financial life.
I found that the smaller the group, those 10, 12, 15, and the longer the session, there's some kind of correlation between the size of the group and the length of the session, that people are more willing to open up. And it's pretty great when you have an engaging conversation around money. Money is not talked about enough, as you and I know, and having a safe space without judgment can really open up the conversation. I've had really personal questions posed, and I feel honored that people are willing to do that. So building a level of trust, you know, in a room of 100 people, and it's a, you know, a quick overview, it's not so much. You still get some good questions, but
there are some very obvious connections between general financial literacy and an employer in terms of things like the company match on an RRSP, ensuring that you utilize as many of your employee benefits to mitigate health and wellness expenses. What are the most important connections that you would draw, given the context of the room that you're in, such that you get the most they have the most insight from your time with them?
Right. So once you've got a good handle on the basic fundamentals, the essential fundamentals that we talked about, then the time allowing and perhaps a second session, you get into group RSPs matching. It's free money, but it's surprising how many people are hesitant to sign up for a matching. They think there's some kind of catch or something like that. So what is your pension plan like? Is it a defined benefit? Is it a defined contribution? Do people understand how fortunate they are to be with an employer who has a pension or even a group RSP? And something down to, interestingly, the paycheck and all the details of someone's paycheck. There are a lot of numbers. There are a lot of little abbreviations. There's almost never a legend. Why does my paycheck go up towards the end of the year and then it goes down in January? What just happened? Well, it's because of Canada Pension Plan and employment insurance deductions stopping and then starting up again in January. And when you start a new job, sometimes you're hesitant to bother the HR department, or you don't want to sound I don't know, ignorant of what the paycheck, or you don't know what your paycheck. Anyway, something is basically that. And you should be, a presenter should be tailoring to what's important to that specific workplace.
Are there any boundaries that you worry about crossing in an organization? So for example, one of the things that I would talk about if it was a general environment is you got to ask for a raise. You got to do everything you can to increase your income. I might be less passionate about that message if I was being paid by an employer.
Yeah, so that's definitely tiptoeing, shall we say, through that little minefield. And obviously everyone needs to be paid a fair wage. And so I don't actually talk about asking for a raise, unless I'm talking to human resource professionals, because getting the message across that this matters, you can, when speaking with human resource professionals, when people are short of money, they're not doing well, there's three things that they'll do. They'll ask for a raise, they'll find another job, or they'll go into debt. None of those is good for your company. Asking for a raise, so teaching people to manage their money better is actually the best solution for everybody, for the employee and the company and the human resource professional.
Very interesting stuff. Steve, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Bruce. Nice to see you.
Steve Bridge is an advice-only financial planner. His firm is called Money Coaches Canada. And one of the things that he does is works with employers to have this conversation about financial literacy. If you are someone with any influence in your organization, either you've got a line item to bring in a speaker, or you can influence the person who does orchestrate those sessions, I highly recommend financial literacy being a topic that that you host in an organization. You'll be amazed at the conversations that occur in the cafeteria or the food court after the fact. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Bruce.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later, a report from Mercer found millennials who rent for their entire careers have to save more money for retirement, a lot more, than those who own their own home. Mercer partner Jillian Kennedy takes us through its findings. But first, a strategy that aims to help you pay no tax on your tax bill. You know, I am deeply ambivalent about this topic. I think we should learn more about the strategy. As a Canadian, it kind of makes my heart weep a little bit. Darren Shrosby from 33/7 is here to talk about how it works. I am also the money columnist for CBC Radio. And so every Wednesday, while you're driving home from work or getting dinner set or going for your afternoon walk, I am talking to the afternoon program hosts about financial topics relevant to you and your life. So you can join us on CBC Radio every Wednesday afternoon.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Most listeners of this show live in Canada, and there are huge benefits to living in Canada. The mountains, the prairies, the cosmopolitan cities, the food, the opportunity, and there are huge costs, especially taxes. It is a part of living in Canada that we pay a chunk of our income in taxes. Our next guest has a strategy to help his clients pay little to no tax and, in his view, dramatically increase their net worth. Does it sound a little too good to be true? We're going to find out about something called the tax-free zone. Taryn Shrosbury is the founder of 33/7. He joins us now to talk about it. Hello there.
Bruce, how's it going?
I am well. The tax-free zone. What does this mean?
Tax-free zone. It's a little fairly well-known in some circles and fairly unknown in other circles. It's a little thing that helps Canadians to pay less tax. And as much as I love living in Canada, We do have a fairly aggressive tax system in this wonderful country. And my job is to help people just to reduce their taxes a little bit so that they can keep some more of their hard-earned money for themselves and their families.
Well, it doesn't sound like a little bit. It sounds like your aim is to reduce it dramatically.
Yes. Yes, it is dramatic. I'm trying to be a little bit glib.
But, right. Tell us how it works.
Very, very simple. So this is for the domain of entrepreneurs, primarily people that have businesses and have corporations. So if you have a corporation, you're lucky because you are now taxed at the lowest of the G8, which is at about between 9, 10, 11% on your corporate tax rate, whereas your personal tax rate is about 50 to 54% if you're in the higher ultra high net worth bracket. So what we do is we're running an arbitrage between those two numbers. It's very, very simple. The corporation gets corporate retained earnings coming in. So you sell your widget and you make, let's just use $100,000 as an example. Let's say you make 100 grand. That's corporate retained earnings. If you take the $100,000 out of your corporation, you have to pay tax. Easy math, $36,000 of that is a dividend tax. So 36 grand of the $100,000 goes to tax, which is a lot, right? So how do we pull money out of a corporation and not pay income tax? Well, it's very, very simple. The corporation buys what we call the tax-free zone. The mechanics behind that is the corporation takes the $100,000 and buys a participating whole life policy owned by the corporation. So let's use Sun Life or Equitable Life as an example. Let's say Equitable Life sells you this policy. So you take $100,000 and you pay the premium, which is 100 grand, right? You then go to a third party financing company. Let's use Scotiabank as an example. Scotiabank then funds you back the $100,000. What have you done? You've essentially exchanged income for a loan. The loan is now taken personally. And as you know, Bruce, loan income is not taxable in this country or any other country in the world. Therefore, you've taken your tax rate from 36%, which is your dividend tax rate, down to 0% because it's a loan. So now I have saved you 36 grand per $100,000. That is the tax-free zone.
And you make a fee in some way. This is not out of the kindness of your heart to help these entrepreneurs. How do your economics work?
This is the most wonderful thing. My hand is never in your pocket. I get paid a commission directly from the insurance company. So my services are 100% free to my clients.
And at what asset level or income level does this strategy make sense? You used 100 grand as an example. Would it make sense for an entrepreneur who has retained earnings of just 100 grand, or is this something for those who have 10 times that?
Yes, because don't forget, Bruce, this is a ongoing situation. So you're doing 100 grand a year for minimum of 10 years. So the solution lasts forever, but the commitment is $1 million. So it's a minimum of $1 million. Over the 10 years. So the wherewithal is you would need to make about $250,000 gross for you to make this work. So our rule of thumb is, generally speaking, $5 million of personal net worth, which is basically you just have a house in Toronto, which is kind of crazy, but true. So generally speaking, $5 million of net worth and making about $250,000 a year, that will afford you the ability to do $100,000 of the tax-free zone per year with no muss, no fuss. That's kind of the benchmark.
You named a couple of mainstream institutions, Sun Life, Manulife, Scotiabank, whatever. So the big insurance companies and the big banks. Are they clear that this is how some clients are using products like whole life insurance?
Yes. So this is a $1 trillion industry with a T. It's been around for 147 years, not only in Canada, but in every other country in the world. It is extremely well known. This is not a loophole. It's written into the Canadian tax code, and the allowance is called the capital dividend account. So we're not working in the gray. Like, I wouldn't go on a recorded Cirrus situation and be like, oh, this is some dodgy, you know, tax dodge. It's not. It's well known to the government. And obviously, if Scotiabank is funding it and Sun Life is providing it, these are not small companies. These are, you know, $100 billion companies. So this is not, you know, some random South African dude in the back room with a little green hat saying, hey, I can save you taxes. This is a $1 trillion industry that is called tax efficiency. This is not tax avoidance. This is not tax evasion. This is financial planning 101. And how do you plan? Well, you know, you use strategies that minimize tax, minimize risk, and maximize your personal net worth. And this is one of those strategies. It's not a silver bullet, doesn't cure everything, but it certainly helps you to feather your nest.
What are some of the most frequently asked questions that you get as you're talking to entrepreneurs about this strategy?
You nailed it right in the beginning. It's too good to be true, right? So, you know, that we get that a lot. Don't forget that in the 1700s, no one had ever heard of a mortgage. You know, if I was sitting down in a coffee shop and was lamenting the fact that I couldn't buy a house because I didn't have the capital, and someone leaned over from the adjacent table and said, "Oh, by the way, stranger, I'll finance your house for you," I'd look at this person and say, "Well, that's too good to be true. It's got to be nonsense." But right now, I'm pretty sure that most Canadians know what a mortgage is. So it's not, the concept is not new. It's just new to you. So it's a very, very interesting concept because it is not that difficult to understand. So we get the too good to be true. That's one of the first things that comes out. And then the second thing is always about, oh, is CRA going to flag me for audit and that kind of stuff? And I'm like, no, it's not, because it is life insurance, and you do need life insurance as a business owner and all that good stuff. The other questions are affordability. How much do I need to make, which we've addressed. And there's a couple of other sort of longevity questions about, you know, how do I do estate equalization, and can my kids get the benefit, et cetera, which is, yes, they can.
There are the mathematical questions and whether or not you surpass the threshold for this to be a fit. There is also some values questions, I think, for people who would consider doing this. There are those who would say, 100%, I am doing whatever I can to be as efficient as I possibly can on taxes. And others would say, listen, I am a high income earner. I expect 50% of my income is going to go to tax to fund the roads and the hospitals and the schools and the defense and education and all those sorts of things. And I'm oversimplifying the three levels of government, but you get the idea here. Do you think there are those for whom this just is inconsistent with their values as Canadians?
Yeah, there's the happy taxpayer, and then there's the person that wants to provide, well, not provide, wants to pay as little tax as possible. And that goes down to your core values and all that kind of good stuff. Do remember that there is a thing called death and departure tax. So when you do die in Canada, they have a nice little thing called death tax, and that's another 25% of your estate goes to the government. So either way, you know, you're going to die and you're going to get taxed again. So if you're fine with paying 50% through your life, and then when you die, pay another 25%, once again, happy taxpayer, then that's good. That's okay. So most of my clients we pay GST and sales tax and probate tax, and it's never ends. Like, we pay tax on our investments, et cetera, et cetera. This is just one little slice of relief. It's not, like, it doesn't take your tax bill to zero completely, but it definitely helps. But yeah, to your point, it's your personal choice. If this is not for you and if you want to keep paying tax, happy day.
Yeah, again, certainly we have listeners to this program who are high net worth, ultra high net worth, and then we have most listeners who are regular people. I got regular jobs. They don't have the ability to take advantage of a strategy like this. And I can imagine for them, it's not super palatable to think about the richest among us paying virtually nothing on income tax.
Correct. Absolutely. So this is the domain of the high and the ultra high net worth, and it has been for generations. You know, Elon Musk doesn't pay a lot of personal tax because he uses Tesla stock as leverage, right? So he pledges the stock and he borrows against it. And that, you know, that philosophical argument has been going on for longer than we've been alive, and probably will continue to go on long after we're not here. So that comes down to personal preference. I don't know. I'm okay with, you know, paying what I think is my fair share. I don't think that, you know, ultimately, if you're paying 54% income tax, plus you're paying real estate tax, plus you're paying sales tax, you're at about a 75% tax rate. I think that's a little high. But that's just my personal preference of not paying that much. But, you know, we can sit here and, you know, debate the finer points of how much we should be paying for quite a long time.
What do you think's your fair share?
Oh, this is such a complicated question. I think my fair share is based on, oh God, and this is a very tricky subject.
It is. And I don't think there's a right answer. I think it is a really thoughtful question. And I appreciate your generosity in me asking, allowing me to ask you that question, because it's not a question we really think of. Like most people think of taxes as something done to them. They don't ask that question of what fair share is. And I think it's an important one.
Yeah, absolutely. I've bandied about the question of usage tax or consumption tax, whereas if you're going to go buy bread and milk, there should be no tax on basics, I don't think. But if you want to go buy a Lamborghini, I think it should be taxed a lot, right? So I think that, there's wealth tax and consumption tax. What I don't really appreciate is the most productive people in society that make, provide a ton of jobs or whatever the case may be, they get taxed a lot, which is a disincentive for them to do even better. Whereas, but then again, that comes up against some moral issues. So I wish I knew the answer. Like, is there a flat 10%? Like, if everyone just got taxed at 10%, does that actually make more for the government? Some people say that does, because it incentivizes people to, take more risk and put more, profit back into their businesses and hire more people, and it's good for the economy, et cetera, et cetera. So I think taxes should be dynamic, and the system is complicated, and unfortunately, it's unfair the way it is now, and it's not getting any fairer in any country in the world. It's getting worse, which means the wealth divide is getting more and more stark, as you can see. There's not one country in the world where the wealth divide is diminishing. It's increasing everywhere. So you're either on one side of the wealth divide or the other, and it's, if you're on the side of the not so wealthy, it's tricky, difficult, right? And it's getting more difficult. How do we solve that? I wish I knew.
Well, you just figure that out. And once you've figured it out, we'll have you back. We'll talk about that other side of the equation. Darren, thank you for joining us today.
My absolute pleasure, Bruce. It's always wonderful to chat to you. Thank you for the invitation.
You're totally welcome. Jaron Shrashbi is the founder of 33/7, and we were talking about something that he calls the tax-free zone, a method, as Darren has said, has been around for a long time that enables high net worth, ultra high net worth people to pay less on income tax. Stay with us. Jillian Kennedy from Mercer Canada is going to join us to talk about findings from the Mercer Retirement Readiness Barometer. They kind of shorten that down. That is a very long phrase. So stay tuned for that. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, simple to do that, we have a newsletter. It goes out once a month. We don't do anything with your email address other than send you that newsletter once a month. And it includes all the stuff that this show covers, my work on CBC Radio and CityLine and BNM Bloomberg. To sign up, just go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
All right, we're going to talk about saving for retirement. A report from Mercer Canada found millennials who rent for their entire careers are going to have to save more for retirement than those who own their own home. According to the Mercer Retirement Readiness Barometer, Jillian Kennedy is a partner at Mercer Canada. She leads the firm's Canadian financial wellness strategy, and she joins us now to talk about these findings. Hello there.
Hello.
Were you surprised by this finding number one about renters versus owners?
So we were not surprised. We've been watching this generation for a long time for three reasons. One, they're just not going to have the same level of investment return that past generations have had to grow their savings and rely on that time horizon of compounding interest. But also they have increased levels of debt and now have to deal with cost of living. So we're not surprised by the gap that we've seen with this generation in general.
It is it's like taking a wound and pouring salt and vinegar on it. And then, I don't know, putting your arm in the microwave, something like that, because we already know how difficult it is to afford a home. And that felt like a present issue, but what you're pointing to is it is a future issue, one that is going to have consequences decades and decades later for these millennials.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly why we did the study, is because there's still time to really invest in how this could look different for every generation. But we think it's so important that the steps that individuals are taking now will impact how they'll be able to retire, if they'll be able to retire, and what that retirement looks like in 20 years from now.
Tell me about the math here. So there is a mathematical case to be made for renting and owning to be precisely the same. That is not how it unfolds in practice. What are the differences?
So we wanted this to be really simple. The whole thing, the whole purpose of this study is to encourage discussion. So let's talk about the math. We needed to create two different personas, but we wanted these personas to have the same total kind of, you know, level of behavior. So we assumed they both started saving when they were 25 years old. We assumed that they had $60,000 in earnings, and we assumed that they would both need about 69% of their pre-retirement income in order to be able to retire and afford that retirement. So we started with these two personas having this exact same ways of being able to reach and transition to retirement. And of course, as a consulting firm, we have lots and lots of ways to model different economic outcomes. And so we did this type of modeling and landed on the 75th percentile of outcomes from a financial perspective. But what's really important is what we overlay on top of that. Mm-hmm. So we took someone who owned their home as paying about $500,000. So that's the average from the Canadian Real Estate Association. Again, this is a starter home price. We all know that maybe you can't afford something, that something like this might be much, much higher in certain areas, but this is the average. And then we assumed that somebody who was renting was paying $2,000 a month. And that's where we were able to start to see the deviance and the gap among these two personas.
How big a gap, when all is said and done, at whatever age you decide retirement begins, what's the order of magnitude in terms of how this plays out?
So there are three findings. The big headline finding is that those who rent their home would have to save 50% more than those who own their home. I mean, the bottom line is, and I think we probably all know this in practice, is your home is equity. And if you think about the three-legged stool, going back to fundamentals, the first stool is government benefits. The second leg of that stool is going to be your own personal savings. And the third is equity. And your home is a big part of that equity. But
does it make the assumption that the homeowner sells that home as a way of funding their retirement in part?
So we didn't go that far because this is where we want the discussion to start. We recognize that people will have different thing, you know, different ways of treating that equity in retirement and throughout retirement. We also know that some individuals might not have paid off their entire mortgage. We know all of this, but what we want to highlight here is that having a home allows for flexibility. It increases affordability. It increases the quality of life because that person now has that equity that they can do something with, whether it's reverse mortgages or renting out or downsizing or what have you. Whereas that renter is always going to be subject to cost of living increase, affordability issues, and being later in retirement just doesn't have the same type of tools that the home equity provides.
What would you say to a 27-year-old listening to this program who does not have a parent who can underwrite the down payment? Should they sell both their kidneys and their corneas, I don't know, and anything else that they can sell just in order to get on that housing ladder?
So I think the first thing that I would, that we, so this is what came out in the research. This is a very resilient generation. And we do find that there is still time. This is a point in time study. Things could get better. They could get worse. But I think that there are two key takeaways. First of all, we find this generation often has access to some type of workplace program that they can get matching, or they can have some type of discounts in fees or some type of incentive to be able to save. And this generation just does not participate in those workplace programs to the same level that we've seen past generations, because they want the money to be accessible. And so there's kind of a call to action here. Please, please, please take a look at your workplace programs and prioritize that as part of your financials, but also encourage your employer to offer you more flexibility so that you feel comfortable doing so. And then the second call to action is really around financial well-being. We see this in the health space. We know what we need to do to be healthy. We also know what we need to do to be financially well. And so there is some hygiene here to create some good confidence, to be able to have the tools to continue to be resilient and to know when you need to change your course of action. So making sure you're budgeting, making sure you understand what your wants and needs are in that budget, making sure you reach out for help when you need it, and paying down debt.
Your report also talks about not being risk averse. What do you mean?
So we also have seen that in times where individuals are either struggling with prioritizing their money, maybe they have debt, or maybe they're just really sensitive to downturns that we see in financial markets with lots and lots of bad news, potentially creating negative returns. And we actually also took a look at a person that might be transitioning into retirement, and we assumed that they just exited the market. They just sold off all of their equities and were sitting in just a very safe, you know, interest-based GIC for just 3 years before they go into retirement. And we actually found that that individual would have a 10% lower probability of being retirement ready. And so there is also a call to action that, you know, you have time on your side, not only towards retirement, but also in retirement, you continue to invest. And so taking some risk to grow your capital, obviously being mindful of what the risk you're taking based on your tolerance, is always prudent to be able to grow your money faster.
Depending on what you do for a living, there is a certain amount of labor mobility in this country, and all houses are not priced equally. As you say, that average around 500 grand will get you absolutely nothing within 50 kilometers of a major city, but it could buy you a fully detached home in some communities. What advice do you have on millennials really testing their assumptions about where they live and where they choose to build a life?
So I would say taking into consideration, you know, your long-term equity and how you grow that equity. But that's easier said than done. On paper, you can absolutely create a good plan to grow your equity, but you still have to have a good quality of life, right? And so this is the behavior we're starting to see in the research, right? The quality of life is of utmost importance to this generation. And I want to say all generations we're seeing this data. And really, this is around this concept of I want to have fun. I want to enjoy my life now in this moment. So there's a balance there, right, of making sure that you've got the good equity, but have that good quality of life. And I think it's just so great that there are more opportunities now within the workforce to achieve that.
You mentioned how millennials participate less in certain employer plans. Does your data show that they have a harder time making trade-offs between their current self and their future self? Is that anecdotal, or does the data back that up?
That's absolutely what we're seeing in the data, but I also think that there's a call to action to move to allow more flexibility within retirement plans. I do have, you know, all of the, you know, I do see those individuals that are trying to make a decision between, do I take this money that's coming off of my pay that's going to lock in for 20 years, or do I take this money and I actually use it towards paying down my debt? These are questions we get all of the time. And I think the call to action to employers is to allow for this flexibility so that these decisions don't have to be made. You know, match someone's contribution to a retirement program and allow that company money to grow while still allowing that employee to access that. And I think we're not too far away from that, to be honest, because we see that this is already happening on the health side, where more flexibility has been added to personalized benefits. And we'll see this on the financial side as well.
Thank you, Jillian, for joining us today. It is a very helpful conversation. It's very insightful, your findings. I just wish it smelled more like chocolate cake, you know?
I do too. It was,
I know. I just love. Now, I will say I have a pan of chocolate brownies that my 13-year-old made. So I'm going to remember every word that you said, but I'm also going to go and have half that pan of brownies to just
I love it. Get over it. Sounds great.
Jillian Kennedy, partner at Mercer Canada. She leads the Canadian financial wellness strategy. And she was here to talk about the Mercer Retirement Readiness Barometer. In particular, the difference that millennials will see if they choose to rent for their entire careers, or if they choose to bite the bullet and buy their own home for $50 million trillion. Only partly kidding. That is our show for today. A thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, for an easy way to get a hold of us for your comments, your questions, your story ideas, your feedback, your tips on where to buy a house for less than $30 trillion gazillion. Send us an email to ask@moolala.ca. Our newsletter subscription is at moolala.ca. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you download them currently. And on social media, I am a reluctant tweeter, not a great tweeter, but you know, I've got links to all sorts of cool content. Twitter is at Bruce Sellery, S-E-L-L-E-R-Y, Bruce Sellery, Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.